Our next speaker is Owen Brody, and he has a very interesting title, Microbes, Minerals, and Models.
I think the fun part was soil. It's deliberate. And I don't know if you can, let me see. Have we got a... There we go. Yeah, see, Homer is showing his allegiance to soil here. This has been a great session. Thank you very much for inviting me. I'm really delighted and honored to be here as part of the International Year of Soils. And I began my career as a soil microbiologist, and I've nice weaved my way around and now really come back to focus. This is mainly my main topic. I wanted to follow up with what Adina was saying, and that's really the critical importance of spatial interactions and structure in soil. But also on the part of that the biology is not... it's not just interacting with biology. The biology is interacting with the physics and the chemistry of the soil, and many of those interactions are non-linear and very difficult to predict. Those interactions are between microbes and minerals, and I'm going to talk about how we can potentially use models to both interpret information, generate hypotheses, and predict. What I'm going to present my name is first up here, but mostly been carried out by Eric King, who's a postdoc in my lab, and Ulash Karawaz, who's a scientist in my group. Along with a broad, wide number of other people who I'll acknowledge as we go through. So, soil is the most complex ecosystem. I agree with this. This is an image, an X-ray micro-CT image. I should keep on repeating, but an individual soil aggregate of about 100 microns across. You can see what's happening here now as you're reconstructing the pore network of soil. This is the network within which microbes live, communicate, interact. I'll get back to this in a little bit. When you zoom in, you see that we may have some interactions, but this is probably a cell that has doubled. Those cells are effectively isolated, they're covered, they're surrounded by clay layers, a clay hutch it's called, maybe due to protection, but this obviously has interactions for the condens they produce, predation of those organisms and their interaction with other organisms. Soil is amazingly complex. Despite this, we love soil. Maybe that's the reason we love soil. As I said, there's many non-linear interactions, and we tend to think of soil and use our intuition to understand and try and predict what we think is happening in soil. Now, if anybody's read this book by Daniel Kahneman, you realize that successful intuition requires, first of all, recognition prime decision-making. So you've seen something before, right? So you're going to recognize it again. A regular and predictable environment so that the observation is repeatable, and prolonged practice. So you've observed this many times, many situations. Unfortunately, I don't think this applies to soil due to its complexity. So in complex systems, soil being one of them, our intuition can actually get us into trouble. We make a lot of assumptions, and there's bias involved in that. One way of getting around this, or helping with this, is to embrace the complexity, but we need a framework to represent this complexity, and representing it in mathematical models, not to replace our intuition, but to support our intuition and revise it. So this is what we're trying to do. We have this massive amount of information and data coming from metagenomics, various types of omics, isolation, in situ characterization, that give us insights, hypotheses into the physiology of microorganisms. What we want to do is take those organisms, our hypotheses about how those organisms work, interact them in a realistic environment, which will impact their fitness, observe, simulate the assembly of microbial communities, the impact of that on reaction rates and biogeochemical processes, the feedback of that on the environment, and then the return impact on that on fitness of the microbial community, and so on and so on. And this is where a lot of the emergence in soil systems or other microbial systems comes from. And our approach to this is to develop what we're calling genome-informed trait-based models, and we're doing this within a reactive transport framework, so representing the physics and the chemistry of the system, but also using the genomic and other omic information to parameterize the functions of organisms within these models. So what do we need to consider when modeling organisms? I'm going to start off with a model of something that's not an organism, it's a car. We might want to understand something about the engine type, the horsepower of the engine, maybe not all the working details of the engine, but some properties of that engine. Intake systems, the size and shape, the exhaust, materials, fuel type, fuel tank capacity, etc. And with that information, what we might be able to do is predict things like weight, the power, top speed, maximum range, efficiency, and emissions, etc. So let's take this rationale to microbes. What would we like to do with microbes? Well, we might want not maybe we don't need to learn everything, although there is room for discovery science, and there's so much we don't know. So we're always consistently revising our knowledge of how microbes work. But things like energy yielding pathways, what electron donors, acceptors do microbes use, what's their optimum temperature, pH, things to do with their size, their shape, their stoichiometry, their growth rate, substrate kinetics, etc., etc. And with this type of information, not all the detail of a microbe, maybe we can predict things like growth rate, biomass, the reaction rates, and the emissions of microbes. So we've been aided significantly through new approaches in omics, specifically, I'd say, high-throughput assembly, binning and annotation, but also improved cultivation of microbes, high-throughput enzyme assays, and things that we've heard about already. I'm not going to talk about these, but some examples. We're working very closely with Jill Banfield and her GGK-based infrastructure to assemble, bin, and annotate. And we're also developing our own approach, doing the same types of things, but then also doing trait reconstruction, trait estimation of organisms, connecting their genes to reaction libraries and matrices of kinetics for those organisms. What really helps with this is strain-level genome reconstruction. It's not always necessary, but gives you an idea of the variability. And when you're trying to reconstruct traits and the trait distributions, it's very helpful to know where they vary at the strain level, genus, species, etc. Okay. I'm going to jump into a model system where we're trying to put some of this together. We're working on floodplains. Floodplains as effectively these biogeochemical hotspots. We're working in Colorado, specifically at the Rifle site in Colorado. And the Rifle site is a floodplain. It's an alluvial aquifer. And effectively what happens here is that as during extreme water table rises due to snow melt, for example, you get overbanking. The river overbanks, deposits sediment and silt and large debris over the bank of the river. And over time, you get these floodplains formed that are almost like a lasagna or a layer cake of organic matter, interspersed with different layers of high organic matter, low organic matter. And I'm going to talk some more about this. So here's an example of looking at the field scale, and this is using surface-induced polarization. So you apply a magnetic field to the surface of the aquifer, and then you let that magnetic field go, and you let it relax, and then you look for a magnetic signature. And what we're doing here is identifying regions that have higher magnetism, basically, and that's a signature of things like magnetite, so precipitated minerals. What that was able to tell us was that we had these buried deposits of organic matter. These organic matter catalyzes the reduction of iron and sulfate, forming iron sulfides, but also things like magnetite that co-precipitate with it. So you can see where these are. These are naturally reduced zones. And these are controlling controlling the redox in this aquifer. As water moves through, oxygen is being scrubbed out due to these organic matter-rich zones, both abiotically and biotically. We're interested in these also because with changes in precipitation and snow melt in these regions, water table is fluctuating, but water table is also the water levels are changing significantly due to differences in snowpack. And as the water table moves, the river stage increases, the water table in the aquifer increases and intercepts zones of organic matter that were previously not intercepted, and that changes the redox dynamics of the system. This oscillates over the year. So you can see in this example here, we've got some buried organic matter. We've got and the water table is here. The water table can move up during snow melt and then intercept this organic matter here. And that results in a cascade of redox reactions. A very simple representation of this is we think of the soil organic matter, the floodplain deposits at the surface here are being mineralized. They're producing ammonia that's being nitrified to nitrate. That nitrate and oxygen is coupling together to result in the oxidation of iron and sulfide. To chemolithic autotrophic processes. So we're trying to put a model together to represent these. What we want to do is represent the biomass and growth reactions with both kinetic and thermodynamic constraints, allocate energy dynamically. I'll talk about what this is. Use the metagenomic data to identify key biogeochemical pathways, link organisms with reactions, and use omics to directly parameterize parameters in this model to provide the values for parameters, and then put genomes back into the environment at the appropriate scales. So this is relatively straightforward. This is a dual Mannode approach. So you've got two limiting substrates, but electron donor, electron acceptor, the biomass abundant, the maximum specific growth rate, So you've got this kinetic limitation here, but also this thermodynamic limitation here, Jin and Bethke. This is basically related to the free energy of a redox couple, so the amount of energy an organism can get from its electron donor accepting processes. It's very important in competition. We've also established this dynamic energy partitioning. This is important because the energy available to microorganisms doesn't just go to growth, or doesn't just go to catalyzing reactions or producing enzymes. It's split between them. So energy comes in through catabolism. First of all, it has to go to maintenance of the organism to keep itself alive, and then the remainder can be split between growth and producing things like enzymes, and we allow this to occur dynamically. So one of the important things, as we've seen already, is that microbes are involved, and we see microbes are involved in various different reactions. We've got nitrogen cycle, sulfur cycle, carbon cycle, hydrogen, etc., iron. But these cycles don't act independently, they interact with each other. And so the activity of an organism in one part of this network will impact the activity and the fitness of an organism in another part of this network. So what we're trying to do is represent the major biogeochemical reactions that are going on, the connectivity between those reactions, and the organisms that carry out those reactions. And what you'll see here is you'll see these are example genomes that have been reconstructed from this site. This is not all the genomes. There's thousands now at this point. And the colors represent their participation in different reactions. So multiple colors on the same line indicates multiple organisms are participating in that. Okay, so we have a reaction network. This is not the comprehensive one, this is just an example, but interacting nitrogen, carbon, metal cycles, for example. Okay. One of the issues with developing and using these types of models is that the kinetic parameters are usually only available for organisms that have been grown in the lab, and very few organisms, and we're trying to get around that by using genomic information. One good example of this is using what's called codon usage bias, and codon usage bias is a signature in genomes that's highly correlated with the growth rate, or the minimum generation time of organisms. So using this, we can either take information from isolates, or we can take information from reconstructed genomes directly from the environment that we have not grown or isolated, and we can predict the growth rate of those organisms, the maximum specific growth rate, not the actual growth rate. And when we do this and we compare it to literature versus genomes, they agree some cases, but in other cases they disagree quite a lot. We don't know whether this is due to differences in the organisms in our system, or errors in either our prediction or errors in the measurement in the literature. When we do comparisons under control conditions in the lab, we grow organisms, we compare their growth rates, and we compare estimates of codon usage bias, or growth rate based on codon usage bias, we get a very strong correlation between the two methods. So this does suggest, at least for these heterotrophs, that this process works very well. Okay, so now we're going to jump into a modeling scenario here. We're back to the rifle floodplain. We have this transect across the rifle floodplain, and we're going to look at this area here that intercepts, this is where the intercepts the reduced organic matter. We're going to look at this 2D slice through the system. We're going to look at connectivity and how the flow of water moving through the system impacts the emergence of microbial communities and the development of different types of biogeochemical reactions. And then we're going to move into a network and show how the network evolves in different regions of this system. Okay, so this should play. Let me see. Okay, so we set this up with this is a slice through that part of the floodplain. Most of the flow is lateral, 300 centimeters per year, and a little bit of water infiltrating from the top through the vado zone into the saturated zone, bringing in oxygen and a small amount of ammonia, and then most of the other components are coming in laterally. We initialize this with the top of the aquifer being oxic, microoxic, and then anoxic. But then this is just the initial conditions, and then it should emerge then after that. What you're going to see is a range of different colors emerging in these boxes, hopefully. Yep. Each of these colors represents a microbial community, not individual microbes, but a cluster we clustered the microbial communities at the end of this, and things are the same color of the same similar composition. What you're seeing is emergence of different microbial communities over time, driven not just by the flow of reagents coming in, but hotspots of organic matter that are embedded at this location here. So you can see the impact that is happening downstream. This doesn't mean anything right now because you don't know what these colors are. I'm going to jump to the next slide. But you can see one thing is clear here is that you get the spatial segregation, separation of microbial communities. Okay, so if we look at the characteristics, each of these bars represents a different organism and their abundances in the different locations. I'll just overlay what they mean. When we look at the rates and the types of organisms there, we can see certain things appearing here. So the organic matter hotspot was around here. We can see that's where we're getting the production of the cellulase enzymes, cellulose degradation, catalyzing glucose fermentation, sulfate reduction, but also subsequent sulfide oxidation as well. Again, you can see glucose fermentation happening here. In these zones here, out of the influence of the organic matter hotspot, we're getting nitrate-dependent sulfide oxidation and iron oxidation. Up here, we have this sweet spot up here. We're getting ammonia oxidation happening up here, and we're getting this sweet spot of anammox right down below, where we're getting some ammonia and nitrate emerging. And I'll go through to the field and show you some examples of where we think this is right. And in other locations here, we're getting coupled sulfate reduction again and sulfate oxidation. So we can see physiologies emerging depending on where they're kinetically and thermodynamically favorable. So we're going to zoom in on these two squares here, one in an oxic region and the other in an anoxic region. And this might take a while to load. Okay, so what you're looking at here is the same reaction network evolving for the two different regions. On the left-hand side, you have the oxic, and you'll see the size of these blue circles. These are basically organisms catalyzing a reaction, so the size is proportional to the biomass. And the only thing I really want you to take note of here is how the colors of the lines and the thickness of the lines changes between the two different regions. Dashed lines indicate consumption of a compound, solid lines indicate production of the compound, and the color is related to the rate of the process. So this is run through now to the 300 days, and you can see in the oxic region here, where's my pointer, the oxic region here, that you have a strong signature of nitrification occurring here. These are nitrifying, ammonia-oxidizing and nitrifying organisms, but that also interacts with producing nitrate and nitrite, which then fuels the oxidation of sulfide and the oxidation of iron. And here we can see a stronger, more anaerobic system here where we've got fermentation of carbon, production of acetate, production of methane, production of hydrogen, which is then fueling other biogeochemical reactions. So this is a very, obviously, a linked, connected network. And the fitness of individual organisms here is not dependent on just their own properties, but the properties of organisms around them that's changing the environment and feeding back on the system. Okay. When we go and we look in the field, we take samples, we see, this is just 16S data in the field, we see a very strong signature of this chemolithoautotrophy, so nitrate or iron or oxygen-dependent iron reduction or sulfide oxidation. And so we set up a field manipulation to test this hypothesis. It appears that nitrate seems to be important for, from our model, that nitrate seems to be important for iron and sulfide oxidation. So we did a field test of this, injected nitrate into a gallery of wells. We could see that the nitrate was completely consumed relative to it behaving conservatively. Iron 2 was oxidized, sulfide was oxidized. So it seemed to be driven by nitrate addition. And then when we look at the transcriptomes over this time point, we can see that right before the injection, we had a chemolithoautotrophic system dominated by plankton mycetes performing anammox reaction, Gallionella aceae probably performing iron oxidation, and Sulfuromonas performing sulfide oxidation. After you inject nitrate, they really become the dominant in terms of both the DNA, but more so the RNA, the expressed RNA of the system, comprising up to about 80% of the total RNA that we could map from this system. And so you look at these, we've got anammox, the oxidation of sulfide, and production of sulfide in the iron, and oxidation of sulfide, and iron oxidation as well by both oxygen and potentially nitrate. So we reconstructed the genomes from these, and we were able to bin out a number of different strains of Gallionella. And Gallionella was not previously known to be involved in nitrate-dependent iron oxidation. It's a microaerophile, so it was believed it was oxygen that should have been involved. But when we look at the bins and we look at the genomes of those bins, we can see that they do have nitrate reductases, both dissymmetry and asymmetry. Nitrate reductase is periplasmic as well. And these different strains within the bins of Gallionella have different patterns, but different temporal patterns. So they occupy different niches in the system. This is something that we're working on incorporating into the model now, but it's clear that chemolithoautotrophy is important in the system as predicted by thermodynamics. Okay, so I just want to finish with a couple of slides about getting the scale right. And we talked about this already. This is Tammy, actually. We're in the field collecting some soils from Hopland. What do? We typically go to the field, we take some soils. If we're looking at the rhizosphere, we may take roots and we shake it off the roots. But what we're doing is we put it into tubes and then we beat the hell out of it. We mash it up. We lose all the spatial context. And then we sequence it. And then we're trying to understand patterns of covariance and correlation and things like that. But those organisms may never covary or interact. There's a very nice paper by Noah Feurer and Jay Lennon, and some quotes from this say, what we're doing here is we're lumping habitats and environmental gradients that on human scales will be equivalent to the heterogeneity encountered in 1,000 kilometers squared. We don't do our ecology at that scale, our plant ecology at that scale. So if we were to sample bacteria at the same scale that ecologists sample grassland plant communities, we should be doing this at 100 microns squared, to be relevant. Okay. So that's the size of a small microaggregate, just as Adina was saying. So when we go back and we look at microaggregates, again, this is the micro-CT data, and we look at it, we look at different regions. Look, this is the pore network, and these are voids. These are volumes in here that could physically support microbes. These are relatively small. We know we've got preferential flow paths through here. We know we've got humps and hollows. So really, aggregates have rivers, streams, valleys, and islands in them at the aggregate scale that's relevant to distribution and connectivity of microbes. It's hard to do this, but other people have done this. And so if you look at, you do thin sectioning and you look at the distribution of microbes in soil, the average distance between bacterial cells and soil is somewhere between 4 and 30 microns, assuming you've got 10 to the 8, 10 to the 9 cells per gram. If you overlay that here with some error bars, you can see that in some cases, if you use this average distribution, some of these are suburbs or colonies that are maybe not interacting with each other in soil. Now, they could interact if the soil becomes saturated, and then the pore connectivity allows diffusion to occur. But most of them depends on the soil. You've got a partially saturated system, so there's no connectivity. These organisms do not see each other. So it raises the question, what's in the biofilms? Is everything co-localized? Probably not due to the cell density. So it means that we've got these distributions of organisms at the micron scale that are not interacting with each other, but maybe all in synchronized to the same environmental factor, and that's why we see all of this covariance and co-occurrence. Maybe. That's a hypothesis. So we'd like to be able to simulate life at the microbial scale. So taking these aggregates, building a digital representation of those aggregates with the pore network, and then putting a reactive transport model into that. We're not quite there yet, but we're starting on this. And this is using these finite volume methods that allow you to represent the solid surface and the fluid matrix as well. So that could represent attachment and changes in permeability, porosity due to microbial growth, and using adaptive mesh refinement. So you've got small mesh sizes where you need them and large mesh sizes where you don't need them to represent your grid. Thankfully, this can run on, it's a lot of information to process on supercomputer platforms. And the next slide gives you an example of non-biological reaction, but this is sort of a silly example, but what we're doing here is we're forcing a solution through here, and it has to get through this neck in between these two parts of the aggregate and work it all this way through. But it just shows that we can simulate the movement of substrates, resources through a network, and the next step is to do this in a more realistic way where you've got radial diffusion coming in, but also put microorganisms in there with distributions that are predicted based on thin sectioning, for example. See how thermodynamics and kinetics plays out in regulating the emergence and fitness of organisms over that scale, and see if we can make sense of these co-occurrence patterns based on that information. So with that, I think my main point here was that we need mathematical tools to simulate how biology, physics, and chemistry interact in complex systems, and especially at the microbial scale. We have this genome-informed trait-based model called BioCrunch, which we're just about ready to publish, and then it will be released into the wild. We're combining genomic, physiological, and biogeochemical data to improve our representation of these reaction networks. And also it's important, these are hypothesis-generating tools to go back, test those hypotheses either in the lab or in the field, and then revise your model in an iterative approach. And using new tools, either modeling or observation tools, can help us understand what life is like at the microbial scale. And then it's important that we go back and we set up our experiments to test and verify and build our models at that scale. Okay, so this is part of a smallish part of a very large project at Berkeley with many collaborators. As I said, Eric did most of the work here, but also Jonathan Franklin, Marco Valtellini, and Dave Trebitich and Terry were involved in the reconstruction of the aggregates and the simulation of those aggregates. And Ulash for the metagenomics and genome interpretation here. And thanks to the DOE for funding this work. And thank you for your attention. Yeah, so the question was, have we thought about how to incorporate fungi into these models due to their difference in growth form, I guess, and spatial dynamics? Yeah, that's an incredibly important part of this. We are working on that. There's a couple of approaches to this. You can't treat them like bacteria in these models. Things like the surface area and the volume is very different, plus the ability to move is very different from bacteria as well. So it sort of requires some form of biophysical model to do that, and that's something that we're working on at the moment. That's a big challenge because you're spanning multiple grid cells when you're doing this. So that's where this adaptive mesh refinement becomes in, because as the fungi starts to grow through, we can change the grid architecture to, just like you would do for a root, for example, you can change it to allow the fungal hyphae to grow through. Okay, so the first part of that was how did we choose the boundary conditions for both the biology and maybe the chemistry of the aquifer simulation? Okay, for the biology of that, we took information from metagenomes and chemical data that we observed, fluxes, reaction rates, and things like that, mostly geochemical measurements, but genomic data, to inform what types of physiologies we thought were important, but not at one point in time or one location, from all the information that came from the aquifer, so which is not necessarily specific to that region that I modeled. And the idea is that you put these in and the environment selects for the organisms that are thermodynamically and kinetically favorable in those conditions. And it turns out in this case, it looks like we caught the emergence of the major physiologies in that. There will be cases when it won't be as easy as that because there's a very big difference in free energy between the electron donor acceptor reactions. So in that case, there was a strong redox drive to that. So if we're talking about metabolite exchange between organisms, this model is not designed to do that at the moment. Maybe later on we could add that complexity in. And then the second question, you're on me. Yeah, well, I think there's two ways. One is it's difficult to make the measurements at that fine scale, but you could make the measurements potentially at the larger scale, learn about the sort of the bulk processes, not necessarily who's interacting, but just who's there, and then put them into the fine scale. I mean, that's one approach until it becomes tractable to do a lot of these measurements at the fine scale. I think you're always going to need to verify your assumptions by looking at the fine scale, but you can't do that in very high throughput. So models are very useful to complement that, I think.